kick it off. Good job.
Sure, sure. Hello, everyone. My name is Blair Chintella. Welcome to the post-Snowden journalism panel. Real quick, though, before we start, who here has heard of Edward Snowden? Wow, Edward Snowden? Okay. Who here thinks that overall what he's done is bad? Okay, who here thinks that what he's done overall is good? Okay, all you will be searched before you leave the room. I'd like to introduce myself. I'm an attorney. I practice law here in Georgia, and I've been following these issues for a long time. And just want to let the panelists here introduce themselves real quick. Go ahead.
My name is Dave Moss. I am an investigative researcher at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Oh, is it going? Before I came to EFF, I was working in journalism for more than a decade, and then I happened to be EFF's media relations coordinator during the Snowden leaks. So right in the middle of the eye of the storm, or, you know, just in the storm in general for three sleepless days there as the 215 order for Verizon came out, and then Prism, and then it was just continuous on for that. And I can talk a little bit about that later on.
My name is Amy Stepanovich. I am the U.S. Policy Manager at a group called Access Now. I work and manage our Washington, D.C. office. And like Dave, I actually was working at a different group called EPIC, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, when the Snowden leak started happening. And those of us who did policy at that time said it was a DDoS attack on privacy policy experts. We basically didn't sleep, I think, for several months. We couldn't work on anything else, and all of a sudden everything else kind of got sidelined. And have been working on this ever since, and on other issues regarding human rights, technology, and surveillance.
So I guess I'd just kind of like to start off a little bit by introducing the topic today. What we're talking about is basically one of the biggest issues kind of our generation, I view, which is big data and civil liberties and how that's going to survive and thrive, hopefully, in the internet age, with all the technology evolving. And you know, whether you like what Snowden did or whether you don't like what he did, you know, you have to admit that he raised some very, very important issues. And if anything, he's exposed a lot of the stuff going on, and so people can hopefully make an informed decision. But at the same time, I do believe that, you know, he did violate the law and should be punished accordingly. If you want, but anyhow, it's the issues here today are not Snowden, and so that's, you know, the issues that he's raised, I think, should be the focus, you know, of moving forward. So let me kind of give a quick overview of some of the programs that have been disclosed. PRISM, which is a collection of a lot of Americans' data, and recently programs codenamed Fairview and Oak Star and Storm Brew have been disclosed, which are basically partnerships with companies, telecom companies, AT&T and Verizon, basically letting the NSA tap into the backbone of those systems. And so that raises some serious issues because there's no warrant per se or suspicion or anything like that. It's the aggregate gathering of this information, and then leads for the typical case, if there are any, are generated by mining the data. So that raises a host of constitutional issues, some would argue, you know, for people's privacy and their civil liberties. Other programs include the phone metadata program, which is not the content collected, but is basically by metadata. It's the to and from information and other duration of calls and stuff like that that's being harvested. And it turns out that there are new disciplines of political science and data analysis coming out. Schools are teaching it, where you can derive a huge amount of information from metadata. You know, whether it be where a person goes after school, who they talk to, the time they talk, the language that they speak in, the duration that they sit on a website and read before scrolling down. All those little tiny pieces of information can be collected and put together from a variety of sources. And so that's what a lot of these disclosures kind of uncover. And with that, I'll let other people contribute.
Go ahead, Dan.
Okay. So two of the things that I've noticed in terms of journalism before Snowden and journalism after kind of fall into two different categories. One is the types of things that reporters are covering, and then the other is what reporters are doing to protect themselves. Now, on the first part, prior to the Snowden leaks, there were some reporters who were covering, the NSA beat, covering surveillance issues. There were far few between, and it wasn't necessarily like your local reporters, your TV crew, or your daily newspaper, and even the major newspapers and magazines. Maybe they had one person who's paying attention to it from time to time. Now, afterwards, you're seeing a whole renaissance in surveillance reporting. Everybody has somebody on the NSA beat. Every local newspaper has been looking at various technologies, whether that's stingrays, automatic license plate readers, drones. These have become issues that people cover because it's if reporters have finally discovered privacy as a value, and that's carried into coverage of data breaches. That's carried over into coverage of cookies that marketing companies are using, and has really exploded. I had a chart that I was keeping of what mentions that EFF got in the press before and after, and it basically tripled, and has stayed consistent in the time since the Snowden revelations. On the issue of what reporters are doing to protect themselves, that has also been a whole fascinating realm of professional scholarship. Maybe that's not the right word for it, but 2012, when I was a reporter in San Diego, I sat on a panel at a hacker convention in San Diego called TorCon, and Jason Leopold, a national security reporter, does a lot of FOIA work, had joined me to talk to the hacker and the InfoSec community about partnering up with journalists and helping journalists not only protect themselves, but dig into these stories. There was maybe 10 people in the room. You look at those same panels that are happening now all the time at every information security conference, at every journalism conference, and they're packed now. Reporters are getting into encryption, whether that's over chat with them and their sources, but more importantly, chat between themselves and their editors. They're using encrypted email. They're using services like Tor to browse the net anonymously. And they're starting to take precautions, and we're actually finally starting to see news organizations actually use secure protocols, HTTPS, so people who are reading their sites aren't having their traffic recorded as well. So it's in those two areas, and it's been very heartening to see this overall sea change in how reporters look at technology and privacy on the whole.
So just to add a little bit, the first thing I wanted to talk about is who journalists really are, because we saw way before Snowden this kind of switch, just due to technology generally, that more people are becoming citizen journalists in their own right. People have Twitter accounts, people have Facebook accounts, people are sharing news, making news, sending news all the time, and really so many people have become reporters. We actually at Access are looking at international laws now, and I believe it's Turkey, although please don't quote me on that, has just passed a law that said anybody with over 3,000 subscribers is now considered a member of the press for legal government purposes, and then they have to register, and they have to go through all sorts of requirements for being a member of the press, which is very interesting. So when we talk about journalism in a post-Snowden world, it's less about them and more about all of us and everybody who is using the internet to share and spread news. Dave talked a bit about the awareness that journalists have undergone of privacy issues in the wake of Edward Snowden. I also wanted to talk about the awareness that governments have come to about journalists in the wake of Edward Snowden. The Obama administration has issued more indictments against whistleblowers, journalists, for breaches of the Espionage Act than any prior administration. So we have this increase in looking at journalists or sources for journalists as criminals, looking at this as a criminal act, just reporting. And that's been something that we've noticed as a pattern, not only in the US, but around the world. Recently in Turkey, and by recently, I mean earlier this week, there were two journalists and their translator who were arrested. And it turns out they were arrested simply for using encryption. They called it military-grade encryption. What they were using was standard PGP email to send messages to each other. After 2 days with public pressure, those journalists were eventually released, but their translator is still in custody and still in prison for helping these journalists exchange information. At the same time, this was only a month after there was an indictment issued against Wesley Lowery, who is a Washington Post reporter who was reporting in Ferguson, this idea that journalists can now become criminals for reporting, and not only reporting tech issues, reporting whistleblowing issues, but just reporting generally. And that has become a huge trend that we've seen in the wake of Edward Snowden.
And it has, there's a long history, or some history anyways, of this issue. I mean, if you look back to the Nixon leaks and Deep Throat, and the whole issue that was raised by Daniel Ellsberg, it's sort of history repeating itself in the modern age, but on steroids, because you have all this evolving technology, and just on a much, much larger scale. I mean, the scale of documents released by Snowden are just so much more voluminous than what was released with the Pentagon Papers. But the issues are the same, so it seems like, you know, what happened with the FISA after those leaks back then, the law that changed didn't quite solve the issue, or didn't settle it anyways. And so here we are today, struggling with the same things. And it is extremely disconcerting to see journalists and, you know, journalists being subpoenaed, journalists being charged. And there's no such thing really as a reporter's privilege. So if you're subpoenaed as a reporter, you know, you have to give over your source or you could face going to jail. Like a reporter by the name of James Risen was faced with going to jail for the rest of his life because he had published some classified information in a book that a source had given him. And so he refused. He, you know, made a huge media campaign, and eventually, I believe they released, they stopped, they withdrew and they retracted that requirement. But it's a real danger out there. And so, you know, using encryption for journalists is very important. And there also needs to be some change in the law, I think, as far as affirmative, explicit protections for journalism and leakers as well. So, so if you have any questions during the panel, just feel free to raise your hand and we'll pass out the box. And you have any horror stories about being spied on or anything? I don't have a story about being spied on, but can anyone hear me?
James Risen,
Well, there's Risen and Risen.
Risen?
Yeah.
Are we
Risen.
Talking about the same person? Because the one with Fox News that was gone after.
Jeffrey Risen, I think it's
Fox News.
James Risen.
Yeah, James Risen is New York Times. Okay. And so he published basically the first story kind of disclosing the Bush wireless war wiretapping with Eric Rickenblau, or Rischenblau, I believe. But then he was subpoenaed a couple years later about sort of a different piece of classified information that he had written in his book. Mm-hmm. So it involved a CIA operation on Iran. So he was under that subpoena until just within the last 6 months or a year, I believe. And he finally got up from under it, so you can imagine that.
Yeah. Okay, my question is, how does being politically correct fit into all of this? Your opinions.
Can you articulate a little more?
I'm in my 70s, and I've watched what's gone on over the years, and I just feel like being politically correct according to what's going on in the news is gagging us. We can't talk about anything anymore because it's not politically correct. That's my opinion.
As far as surveillance in general, or?
Yeah, everything. I mean, listen to what's his name, who's running for president, and Trump. Trump is talking about how politically correct is ruining this country.
Trump, someone needs to surveil him, I know that, I don't know.
I will say, in the world that I live in, I have not necessarily experienced that. I actually see more people willing to say things that are quote-unquote politically incorrect. More people willing to take chances and to call people out for saying bad things. What I also have seen, though, it's not a politically correct thing, but it's responding to really negative laws. There is a chilling effect because we have done things to silence whistleblowers and journalists. And one of those things has been to remove whistleblower protections for government contractors who do a large majority of the work for government now, including Edward Snowden. So maybe not political correctness, but responding to these laws and policies that are being put into place that are actually passed or changed in order to keep people quiet and to keep people from reporting things publicly, and to make sure that you don't end up in prison for saying something that the government disagrees with.
I mean, I would also add that people who hold controversial views, no matter what side of the spectrum we're talking about, are among the people who are most chilled by mass surveillance. EFF has a lawsuit against the NSA called the First Unitarian, being NSA, and it's a coalition of our clients have involved 20 different organizations, ranging from the First Unitarian Church to we have several gun rights groups, we have CARE, the Center for American Islamic Relations. I mean, it's a huge, broad, swath of people with different views that wouldn't necessarily cross paths otherwise. But the issue is, if you have a controversial belief, there may be somebody who wants to keep an eye on it.
So I guess one of the questions I would have is there a concerted, organized governmental effort on the federal and state levels to actively dissuade the journalists themselves, not necessarily the leakers or people who are giving them information, but is there, do you allege that the government has tried to infiltrate news organizations, that sort of thing?
Some of the leaks from Edward Snowden have shown that Al Jazeera was infiltrated. Also, Thomas Drake, who here is familiar with Thomas Drake at all? Okay, he's basically another whistleblower who came forward, and he stated several times that there was a program that hasn't been reported on that often. It was called First Fruits, and basically it was a program under the Bush administration to specifically target journalists in order to cut to the chase and not wait for the stories to come out. And so there's been stuff that has happened like that, and so the issue is, I mean, it's hard to get information about it. I mean, obviously it's wrong, but and then by the time some things come out, if they come out ever, then you have to go back 3 years and try to find the culprits, which you can't do. So, but there have been instances of that. There was, even going back to Project Minaret, talking about back when 40s and 50s, and I believe, and Project Shamrock with NSA, making copy of all the incoming electronic communications in the country back in like 45. I mean, there are instances, I keep going back to Nixon because the more I read about him, I'm like, God, I hope we don't get to that point again. But
several AP reporters had their landlines at their offices tapped, and who were suspected of communicating with confidential sources in the government so that the government could figure out who the sources were. There is the targeting of the journalists themselves. It was their phones that were tapped. But then also, in order to shut down their sources of information so that they will stop reporting on things that the government doesn't want them to report on, namely that revolver.
That happened before Snowden. It was amazing. It was a huge scandal, and then suddenly Snowden happened, and it dropped off most people's radars.
It was the week before? Week or two before.
I'm not sure if you guys are familiar. There's a piece of software called, it's a suite of software called SecureDrop, and it uses GPG and Tor to sort of make it safer for people to leak data to journalists. Do you have any thoughts on that, or do you know of any other pieces of software or other ways that, or other efforts to get journalists and leakers to be using encryption and this kind of technology?
So SecureDrop is currently managed by the Freedom of the Press Foundation, which one of EFF's former activists left EFF to become the, executive director of that organization. Trevor Tim. I believe we are legal counsel to Freedom of the Press Foundation. I think we share board members with them as well, so we are definitely very familiar with it. One of our technologists also left to work pretty much exclusively on SecureDrop. So yeah, we are very familiar with that. I mean, obviously I find when talking to journalists, it's sometimes quite a leap to get them to pick up inconvenient technology. They move fast. They want to get stuff out fast. Sometimes they can't be bothered with, even strong passwords. So the things I try to talk to them about first is OTR. That's, an encryption a system for doing instant messages between people. And that's probably, it's like the single simplest thing to do. And that's one of the ways I sort of start. I'm like, you know, work with that, work up to PGP, you know, work up to Tor. Start with just making sure your conversations with your editor are not open for it to be intercepted by, you know, people who might be interested in your story.
And actually, Dave brings up a point. I'm going to segue off part of what you said. There, a lot of journalists in DC will talk about how not usable these encryption tools are. There's actually an infamous story about a journalist who was trying to send a PGP email and ended up sending it in plain text on accident, because these tools are very hard to use if you are not properly trained on them. And so it's the idea that actually post Snowden, these tools have started to trend toward being made easier for the normal person to pick up. And that is something that has happened not only to impact journalism, but to impact everybody, is that it's now easier to pick up encrypted tools and to start using them. And I think we're going to start to see that getting more and more easy as time goes on. The interfaces, the user side has gotten easier. And so I think we've all slightly benefited from journalists recognizing that they need to use these tools more by also having tools that we can pick up and use more easily.
So I think you answered part of my question just now. I work in a lot of activism. I work with lots of immigrants' rights groups and partly with the Black Lives Matter group. And I know that in many instances it's been reported that different police groups and different smaller local agencies have been infiltrating some of our groups in order to get intelligence on a very, very localized level. Mm-hmm. Aside from those programs that you mentioned, what other steps could small organizations take to ensure that they're not just being infiltrated in their communications, but they're not being surveilled by police, for example?
There are services that will do security auditing. Security auditing can be very expensive, but for nonprofit groups, you can find places that will volunteer to do security auditing for you. And what that will do is go in and tell you where you're vulnerable from a tech perspective. I don't know if anybody has ever solved the espionage human infiltration problem, but you can look to see if you're using the right tools to communicate securely and where your weak points are. And really to start thinking about that as early as possible. You don't want to be thinking about security after a very sensitive email has already been obtained by a threat actor. You want to start thinking about it as you start collecting information, as you start having these communications, and make it very easy for people to communicate with you securely. If you have PGP, publish your keys on a public server. Make them available so people not only know that this email address has a key, but it's mine. Try to find ways to get that information out there and to communicate it widely.
Yeah, the ACLU just put out a really interesting paper, which I've only gotten through a few pages of, but it's interesting so far, about how police use sock puppets or anonymous accounts or fake accounts to infiltrate and surveil groups. I've been trying to get people to use the word copfish for it. It has not quite picked up, but
I'll pick that up for you, Dave.
Yeah, copfish. We have been talking to Facebook quite a bit about this issue, because Facebook has its authentic identity policy, and it will kick off average people, for using, pseudonyms or, pretending to be people they're not. But police seem to be doing it wholesale. New York Police Department has public policy that says, oh yeah, we do this. The Georgia Bureau of Intelligence has a policy that is used by the International Association of Chiefs of Police. It is actually used as a model policy for doing these kinds of investigations. But all of these are outside of the terms of service for Facebook. And Facebook has said, well, we'll take these pages down if you point us to them, but by the time you find out about them, the damage has probably already been done. So probably it's a hard issue to tackle. I mean, other than just making sure that you have a good circle of trust, and then if you do have a private group that is communicating amongst themselves, that you know who they are, and that you're just verifying people's identity other than just this is their picture.
Yeah, to
So, I mean, for texting, there's things like Signal. I think that's one that we
text
use.
Secure.
And Text Secure is another one. So those are ones we use.
Just use ones that are that you trust, that you've done some research on. And be ever vigilant. There's a story out of EFF that just happened that was reported on, where one of the EFF employees got called by who was supposedly a reporter and asked her to respond to some press questions. She asked him to email the press questions, and he emailed her a phishing link to a fake Google Doc to try to get access to her communications. So it was, she was being phished, spearfished, like very specific to her. So it's not just clicking on things. The day that came out, and this could have been totally innocent, but I got a Facebook friend request from somebody who said that they were a journalist in their name. And you know, I have very, very little personal information on my Facebook, but some people have a lot of information that could be deemed very sensitive. And once you add somebody to that account and they have access to that, you can't take that away. You can take away further access into the future, but you've given them all of your information at that point.
Hi.
I've
worked in local television news for about a decade, and I've seen a lot of shifts as far as technology when it comes to, you know, Twitter and Facebook and blogging and all this. And I've noticed a shift in, you know, people wanting to get quick bits of information out instead of the more investigative pieces, the bigger things that people could really learn from. So mine's more of kind of a broad question. When it comes to things like the Edward Snowden, all the way down to something like the Ashley Madison hack, any of that, do you feel like the media does more harm or more good when it comes to keeping people informed? And along with that, do you think they're doing better or worse now than they were previously before the technology shift? Sorry, I know that's big.
My opinion on the media, just in general, is that I don't ever watch, hardly ever watch CNN or the main news stations. I was just talking to my folks about this the other day, but basically I've watched it enough to where it just drones on me. It seems just like one cycle. So depending on the issue, I've sort of like gathered a list of different sources who sort of, you know, specialize in certain topics or whatnot, you know, whether it be, you know, every once in a while I'll see an issue, everything from 60 Minutes to whatever, you know, it doesn't have to be mainstream or whatever, but that's the good thing about the new sort of news out there, is that there are a lot of things you can watch online, a lot of people doing independent reporting. So as far as the coverage of the leaks, I think you'll find better coverage of it in alternative media.
Not found more out on Reddit than
on Reddit,
mainstream news.
People, that's not a stereotypical news organization, but you probably learn more a lot of the time if you look at Reddit. So I encourage looking at those kinds of sources. So
The trend that I've seen a lot, and it's a double-edged sword, is, you know, and this is mainstream press that does this, is taking another organization's story and then writing a blog post about that story and not doing any other additional reporting, but saying, wow, big story, Washington Post said. And for an activism organization, that's actually kind of great, because you see this amplification of a story across multiple media platforms. But on the other hand, for the media consumer, you might look at a story and read it, and then it'll say, you know, as reported by, you know, the Washington Post. You click the Washington Post, it goes to their blog, and it says, you know, as reported by the New York Times. And then you click through that, and the New York Times had grabbed it off the Daily Coast, and the Daily Coast had grabbed it off something else. So I always try to make sure that I do click through that, and that the version I share, whenever possible, is the original version, unless that original version is just, you know, like Seymour Hersh's 11,000 word, you know, piece, where that's not really a shareable thing. But, you know, trying to make sure that I'm sharing, you know, whoever, the version of the story that actually saw the documents firsthand, did the interviews firsthand, because by the time you get to three or four, people are misinterpreting information. And that's happened to things that I've written, and I'll write one version of it, and people won't even call me to do an interview on it, they'll just start writing off of it, and then that'll get shared three, you know, re-reported three times, and I'm like, and then I have to call the reporter to be like, glad you wrote about it, thank you so much for writing about it, but can you tweak this? And the last thing a reporter wants to hear is that they have to do a correction.
And a lot of the times when Dave mentioned documents, that's been a trend I've noticed, at least in the last couple of years, is that stories are being supported by actual documentation. So a lot of the stories you read sometimes will say, quoted from an anonymous source or a high official, as opposed to a low official or something. But basically, you're getting to see the original documents that support the story. And so sometimes I'll actually go to the documents, and I'll notice another perspective on the document that the reporter didn't see or I think is actually inaccurate. Mm-hmm. So really, I mean, even from the original source to the first reporter to report on it, sometimes you may get some of that telephone game-ish type of thing. But, you know, this top secretness aside of all the disclosures, You know, I'm not saying that all stories should be supported by top secret documents. I'm saying that, you know, original documents, sometimes regardless of the story, are just good to look at, I think.
Yeah,
too,
as somebody who looks at primary documents and as somebody in the news, I plead to you to include links to primary source documents when you're talking about a primary source document, because trying to go on a mission to find one, and then oftentimes, especially court documents, they're hidden behind a PACER wall. And if you don't, like, I happen to have a PACER account, but for the majority of the world who aren't lawyers, who don't have a PACER account, that is the system that you use to access electronic court filings, and it's a pay system, then it's, you've hit a wall. You can't go any further. The other thing that I actually think is more harmful than investigative reporting, which I find ends up being fairly even, and even with the awareness factor, it ends up helping, are editorials. We've seen a lot of editorials, and I hate picking on the Washington Post, but I actually don't in this instance, coming out of the Washington Post about cryptography backdoors that are trumpeting government talking points about why you need crypto backdoors and everything, or asking for impossible technology like golden keys into pieces of technology that are incredibly harmful because people are reading them and all of a sudden thinking that this piece of technology you can't develop is possible. And why isn't San Francisco doing this? And why aren't the tech companies developing something to help the children? Why aren't you helping the children? And those end up, we end up having to talk to a bunch of people and try to educate them further because they're only providing half the story.
All right. Given the trend of the systematic sort of violation of natural and constitutional law with regards to privacy and the lack of political will to do anything about it, how would you intend to disrupt this and bring the people involved to justice?
Wow, who wants to start? Man, that touches on so many issues for me. To me, I'm hopeful in a way because I see like our country as surviving the leak in one aspect, when a lot of countries would have either imploded or the executive would have gone crazy and harnessed and rounding up people and persecuting people. So in a way, I mean, while I may not disagree with every leak that was out there, I think it shows a sign of strength for the way our country has sort of handled it and what we're doing now, an ongoing debate. So I think keeping that debate alive, to kind of answer your question, is important, and keeping it in people's minds is important. But at the same time, trying to find a way where we can actually keep the stuff confidential or classified that we need to. I mean, some you look at like this chart here of all the Snowden disclosures, some of them are just purely international type stuff. And so for that type of stuff, I would tend to disagree with his disclosure, and I would be on the side of prosecuting him. But some of the stuff I would say that the American public should have known years ago. And so you have to, you know, strike that balance, I guess, as the pundits like to say, you know, between security and whatnot. But I think having panels like this, getting involved, getting more people's opinions, trying to get a consensus, that kind of thing. So
I have to say, I mean, one of the things that's been so frustrating for me over the last couple of years is that, you know, between the WikiLeaks, you know, document dumps, between the NSA document dumps, you see people going after whoever leaked it, but you don't see anybody right. paying a price for actually creating a system that resulted in the leak. I mean, a single, you know, in both cases, a single individual was able to get all those documents out of there, and somebody is responsible for that system, but it all comes on to the person who did it. And yet, you know, Ashley Madison leak, CEO had to resign. I mean, that's been frustrating to me to see that there hasn't been a whole lot of accountability on this. Now, we can sue and try to stop this stuff. I love that the Associated Press is now suing over public records. You know, they can't really do anything else, but because federal law enforcement impersonated AP to go after a suspect and sent him links pretending to be the Associated Press with like a news article or something. So that's something. You know, there's not necessarily a whole lot of now it's beeping at me, it's reverberating. So there's not a whole lot. I wish there was more. I wish we can point our fingers at people and we can, you know, shame them and we can say, you know, this is the terrible stuff. We can make t-shirts like the one that Scott is wearing. But I wish there was more. I really wish there was more.
Well, and not only the people who created the bad programs that were hacked into, but also the people, or the bad systems that were hacked into, but also the people who created the illegal, unlawful, unconstitutional, anti-human rights programs to begin with. I would love to see somebody in government be prosecuted, potentially for lying to Congress or for creating a program that never should have been created under law to begin with. Unfortunately, what ends up happening is we end up passing laws that just create more immunity from legal liability for individuals in government and for companies who comply with these records. We would like for it to go the other way. We are also creating programs that actually make it, by increasing the amount of information that ends up being classified, which we love classifying information in government. Everything is classified. You're increasing the number of people who have to have clearances to gain access to that information, which means you're increasing your attack surface. The U.S.'s policy of overclassification is working against them by creating more people who have to have access to more classified data and giving them more people that they have to watch and keep an eye on, which just increases surveillance. It's a snake eating its own tail.
Okay, so, like, I think more my question was, given that there aren't sort of the direct systematic ways to approach this are not working, how are you going to disrupt this?
We've got several lawsuits. We've got three or four now. I can't even keep track against the NSA itself. We've got lawsuits against the DEA. We've got, I mean, our docket is getting very, very long. But that's because we're a legal organization. And we are an activist organization, so we do, you know, try to affect legislation and policies. But, you know, our organization, our tools that we can, you know, our weapons in this case are the law and public you know, perspective.
And technology.
Oh, that is
mass surveillance. Mass surveillance that gets all of you actually ends up being way too expensive when everybody is using encryption or secure technologies. The reason that they can mass surveil people is they can put a wiretap on a internet line and collect all of your unencrypted communications. So when those communications actually all need to be hacked into individually, it's too expensive to conduct mass surveillance. You're gonna ship them to targeted surveillance. That's a way to disrupt, is actually to disrupt the ecosystem. Another way to disrupt, the US Congress passed the first piece of legislation that actually restricted NSA surveillance since FISA in the 1970s last year. The USA Freedom Act actually stopped the telephone metadata program, which was the very first Snowden leak that happened, that was largely believed to be unlawful, that judges have said was unlawful, judges have said was unconstitutional, and we passed a law to stop it. And I think that was, like, underappreciated. That was huge. And we can pass a law to stop the other unconstitutional, unlawful programs. We have a deadline, December 2017, the FISA Amendments Act, which many people believe was unconstitutional, is up for renewal in Congress. They have to proactively renew it, or the programs all go away. PRISM will go away. And so you can fight against them renewing this law in 2017 and say, no, we are not going to let you continue to surveil all of us unconstitutionally.
This is kind of a left shift, but I'm just curious on your opinion on how Snowden released a lot of documents about his own government surveilling and illegally tapping into people, but yet now currently resides in a country where their reporters of their state, if they tried to say anything against what, you know, the Russian parliament or whatever has to say, then they're prosecuted or killed or jailed or... So there's no freedom really of information too much there. So he's not happy with the US doing it, but now he lives in a country that actively and openly does that without.
My understanding of how that transpired, and I'm not, I mean, for better or for worse or whatever you think of him personally, is that my understanding is his passport was revoked while he was in transit somewhere else and he was stuck there, but then he applied for citizenship or to stay in multiple countries, asylum in multiple countries. So I don't think he said, Russia is my first, that's where I'm going. He had been traveling, trying to find safe haven, basically. And the U.S. government was downing other planes looking for him. They had downed a head of state plane, which is in violation of international treaty. I guess they thought the political fallout, they did the cost-benefit instead, the political fallout from downing a head of state's plane would be worth catching Snowden.
They
gambled and failed. And so that's basically how he ended up in Russia.
If you remember when he was first in Russia, he was stuck in the airport forever. Like, they got him in the airport and he couldn't leave the airport. I mean, the U.S. has basically decided it's more important for them to continue their prosecution of him than it is for him to not be in Russia. If he was able to come back to the U.S., he would come back. But they think, I mean, they clearly think that it's less of a risk for him to be in Russia with whatever they think he has than it is for him to go free and to drop any charges they have against him.
So you touched earlier on the topic of reporters citing source material and documentation. What shifts have you seen in their abilities to do that through official channels, through like the Freedom of Information Act and FOIA requests, and basically has the facilitation of those channels changed? Has it gotten more difficult? Do you see it used more?
So one of my favorite things out there on the internet these days is Muckrock. Is anybody familiar with Muckrock? I will be talking more about Muckrock on my Sunday panel. Muckrock is a service that did exist before the Snowden leaks, but it's become very, very relevant right now. What Muckrock is it's both a news site, but also a tool for it simplifies the public records process. So how that works practically is you would go to their site and you would say, I want to put in a public records request for this. And you put in what you want and it formats it for you. It sends it to the agency, whether that's a local agency or a federal agency. It monitors based on what the law, when they should have gotten a response to you, and sends automatic reminders to the law enforcement agency saying, your 30 days are up, where are my records? And then when the records come in, they're posted there. And they've been able to do things. We had worked on them in the past with what we called the drone census, where we had their community of people growing all the time, and just anybody who wanted to file public records requests with their local law enforcement to find out if they had drones, were interested in drones, had been visited by drone manufacturers, to create a large picture of what everything looked like nationwide. EFF is currently working with them on one related to mobile biometric technology. These are devices that you use for facial recognition or to capture thumbprints or iris scans. And that seems to be really effective. They have probably done more than anybody I've seen on uncovering the use of stingrays, which are fake cell phone towers that collect, locational data and perhaps other things. And there have been certain reporters at various publications who've done groundbreaking, huge stories exposing it. But Muckrock has been able to sort of catalog this across the country, which agencies have it, which agencies have non-disclosure agreements with the manufacturer. That's one of my favorite. I could talk about this for an entire panel, but as far as like answering quickly, one tool I would say is this use of crowdsourcing public records.
There are several exemptions. So FOIA creates a presumption of public disclosure of documents subject to some exemptions. And many of those exemptions have been, for several decades, just expanded and expanded and expanded to the point where so much is just kept. You get documents. I've received stacks of documents, yay high, several of them, with like blacked out pages. B2, B3, B4, all of the different exemptions within the Freedom of Information Act cited. Through litigation from works like EFF, groups like EFF, groups like EPIC, other Freedom of Information Act oriented groups, those exemptions are starting to be chipped away. And you've seen it a little bit before Snowden, and then continuously as people keep requesting documents and there's opportunity to chip at them. They're still incredibly broad, but you're starting to see some more information come out. One of the things I think is really important is revisiting the classification system, because the B3, if you can't tell, the exemptions are in Section B of the law. The B3 exemption is for classified data, which means anything that's classified, they can keep away from you, and they don't have to have it classified when you request it. After you request it, they can look at it and then classify it in retrospect. This is actually also what they did with Hillary Clinton's email. She didn't send information that was classified at the time, but looking at it in the past, they decided it should have been, and they are retrospectively classifying things. And so trying to look at the classification system and revisit what standards are required for things to be classified.
I think that touches on another important issue that you, sir, kind of touched on is, you know, what do you do when you feel like legally you can't get everything that you need to, or you can't affect change? And so I think that environment or that feeling will encourage leakers and people to break the law, which is not good, but some people, when they're desperate, will do desperate things. So, you know, I think we do need, just as a practical matter, to go back and look at some of that stuff so we don't encourage lawbreaking as a society, where we do have reasonable ways for people to get information out, reasonable access to information, you know, stuff like that, so we can, yeah. Any questions?
So there's a number of psychological studies that show that if people know they're being watched, they'll sort of self-censor and stay away from controversial or anti-authority viewpoints. Have you seen that effect show up in the way the general public looks at journalism and media since the Snowden revelations?
I think there have been some polls that have shown an uptick in that. I can't cite them off the top of my head. I know that less the general public, but you know, our clients are 20 odd groups. I mean, all of them have said that they've seen either a drop off in calls to their hotlines. Their members have censored themselves as a result of that. Now, thankfully, I think in America we tend to be a very loud country and we speak a lot, and so thankfully we live someplace where people are willing to take risks to talk and, you know, be brazen about it. That isn't necessarily true everywhere else in the world, and it isn't necessarily true with every population in the U.S.
And there's an increase in recognition of this internationally. The United Nations Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Expression recently released a report that showed that in order to exercise your freedom of expression, you should be able to use encryption, and you should be able to communicate anonymously, and that those two things were actually integral to the free exercise of expression. So the international community is starting to pick up on this I have nothing to fear because I have nothing to hide argument, and to rebut it quite a bit.
And keep in mind that you know, when I say that you know, we have a First Amendment here, it's a very strong constitutional right that we have, but when the U.S. goes and does mass surveillance, it tells the rest of the world that mass surveillance is okay, that it's okay to tap people, it's okay to collect all their information. You know, there are other countries that don't have First Amendments or have even worse, and I don't like the idea that, you know, repressive regimes are able to say, the U.S. does it, if the U.S. does it, it must be okay.
I think one thing that I can't remember who mentioned it, but I thought it was a great idea. As far as people divulging or whistleblowers, like divulging classified information, I think one defense should be, if it turns out to be illegal, you get off scot-free. Because I think that would make the government think twice. Like, if someone leaks this and it turns out that it was actually illegal what I'm doing, then I'm going to be held liable. I'm not going to be able to chase them across the globe and try to put them in prison for the rest of their lives. To give some more defenses to people who take that risk, not saying that legally they should, but when somebody gets to that point and they do it, I think there needs to be something like that in there. I mean, some of the disclosures are just irrefutably illegal behavior by the government. And if you could somehow raise that in a case, saying, look, it is illegal, have a judge look at it and say, yes, it is illegal, no violation under espionage or something like that. You know, but right now, the way the Espionage Act is written, the way I read the statute and the way all the scholars basically say it, it actually does apply to acts like reporting. So, you know, I think we need to look at stuff like that. I mean, it's applied very sparingly, not so much in recent history, but over 50, 100 years, it's been applied very sparingly. And that's probably why it's not a big issue. But technically, I could apply that to a lot of things out there.
One of the things we do have to be careful about, though, is we don't want to make whistleblowers all require them to be legal experts. You know, Edward Snowden may not have known what was illegal and what was not legal. He sure as hell knew that some of these things looked really, really bad. But he wasn't a lawyer, and not everybody who is looking at these documents in government is going to be a lawyer and know the exact ins and outs and nuances of very complicated law. As somebody who is a lawyer, I can tell you the law is very, very complicated. So we don't want to have to hold them to this incredibly high standard, because then we're not going to get a lot of information that maybe the public should have.
So there's a sort of a debate, I guess, between like maybe a good faith standard where you have a reasonable basis to believe that something you're disclosing is illegal versus it in fact ultimately being determined as illegal. I would have a different opinion maybe, because I think a person who's going to take that step should take that risk if they're going to disclose the information.
I mean, I'm not a lawyer at all, but I mean, I think as a just general person, I can see a difference between taking secrets and handing them over to a foreign government and taking secrets and handing them over to a journalist.
So you had touched on earlier the idea of anonymous sources used by journalists, and as Seymour Hersh demonstrated, it can be used to discredit you in some cases. But I was wondering if there are legal liabilities to having an anonymous source. Like, are journalists, do they have to have a burden of proof to establish that they don't actually know who provided them with information?
Well, I'm not aware of any law that says a journalist could be held liable for having an anonymous source. But there have been instances where the government has tried to say the information in and of itself was never declassified. And that then you get into sort of a legal gray area there, whether even having the information could subject you to criminal penalties.
I mean, they can bring you in and they can ask you questions and you have to tell them the truth, because lying under oath is a crime. So they can only ask you so many questions, and at some point, if the truthful answer is an answer you don't want to give, and that's what happened with Jim Risen, you can just not answer. And then they may be able to hold you in contempt. But I don't think there are any burden of proof laws specifically on that.
And I think that like that issue does not just apply to journalists. I mean, as an attorney, I may have attorney-client privileged information, and maybe one of my clients is under investigation. You know, am I going to have my Gmail email subpoenaed, or am I going to have my letters to my client subpoenaed? I mean, some of the disclosures that have come out have been attorney-client communications being gathered up in this big haystack of information. So really, it's very complicated, because, you know, how do you develop a system where you still respect those privileges? I mean, doctor-patient privilege, you know, clergy and what's the accompanying that, I'm not sure. The clergy and the parishioner privilege, you know, stuff like that. I mean, there's nothing in the programs now that's actually protecting those sorts of privileges. It's just all the information.
So. Blair, you've mentioned a couple times now that you prefer to stay on the side of not breaking the law. And what happens in a hypothetical situation where the federal government mandates we're not allowed to use PGP anymore because of the expense, so they want to protect the NSA's ability to protect. Would you stop using PGP?
That harkens back to the crypto wars, which I don't know an awful lot about. Do you know, David?
Nope, that would be a question for Nadia, I think.
So this is not necessarily a hypothetical question. Not only in the US, but in other countries. The UK is right now also trying to outlaw end-to-end encrypted technologies. I can't answer whether or not Blair would be willing to use PGP at that point. I can say we are fighting these proposals tooth and nail. There is a panel later about the crypto wars and the encryption debate that's happening right now that I am on with Dave's coworker later, and I will happily talk about that issue in great depth.
I'm not worried about it. I was just curious about
me personally.
Because you seem to come down on always don't break the law, pretty much. And I'm just curious, if they stopped, they said you can't use PGP anymore, Blair, would you?
Yeah, I guess just in general, yeah. Okay. But philosophically, you know, as an attorney, I swore to uphold the Constitution and the law. But I mean, if you go back and read some of the slavery debate literature, I mean, you go back and read some civil disobedience, I mean, Martin Luther King Jr., stuff like that. There is a body of philosophy out there to where the law is not the ultimate arbiter of things. And so I think that is an individual decision for each person. It's highly dependent on the specific situation.
I agree. So, to that point, the people who wrote the Constitution were all lawbreakers.
Well, when they were doing it, they were committing treason, basically. Mm-hmm. So,
right. Like Snowden.
Yeah.
What would be the line for you?
Oh, jeez.
Why me? I don't know.
Send me an email and I'll give me some hypotheticals and I'll say yes or no.
PGP encryption as well.
Let's start with an easy one.
Oh, no. One answer. I'll give you one question. Good. Thing.
Nazi Germany genealogical records.
What about electrical records?
Nazi Germany genealogical records.
Genealogical records.
I'm not sure what the question is.
What about them?
Falsify genealogical records? No.
So one question is, why haven't civil damages been used more? You don't see a ton of suits where the government will sue a news organization saying, we're not trying to throw you in jail, but we want you to pay damages for the effect you've had on the state. Why doesn't that get used more?
I can only, not being a government attorney, hypothesize about that. I will put forward one guess, and I am going to preface this with that it's a guess, is that they will not disclose how much money they're spending on these programs. The budget is classified. Everything about them is classified. Their existence is classified. If they were to bring this into court, it's a lot of information that they would have to reveal to the court to pursue a case like that. And I doubt that they want to do that.
But I do think you see that in the private sector. I think like the Hulk Hogan situation, you know, is like a good example. I can't attest to the facts, but as I understand it, it's like Gawker, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Some issue, really, I should have brought it up, but because I don't have it as encyclopedia. But you do see entities who feel like they've been wronged by the press taking them to court with the underlying goal of running up costs so high that the media organization can't afford it.
This might be a Dave question. As a civil servant, I've noticed some of my colleagues don't seem to understand that there's any difference between, or that if they were to encounter something that they felt was not being done correctly, that they basically have a choice between going to CNN or just ignoring it. As an investigative reporter, would there be a tendency to, depending on the information you were being handled, advise them that maybe something like the Office of the Attorney General might, or Office of the Inspector General might be a better route, or is there a tendency to maybe suggest alternate, routes that wouldn't potentially land them in jail?
That's a tough one. So let me take it back an even further step. So, you know, EFF, we tend not to want people to leak documents to us. And if somebody's like, I've got a big stack of stuff, we're like, well, don't give it to us. Go find a reporter and give it to them, and then that's how we'll learn about it. We don't want to be kind of that interface with people. And that's a decision made, you know, a while back, I think, with when Mark Klein had found out about the NSA wiretap at AT&T. That was an anomaly that is different than what we normally do in a situation like that. As a reporter, I mean, you know, I think a reporter, you know, tends to want a scoop, but they do have a certain ethical responsibility towards their source and to leading their source down a safe path. I don't know about whether they would actually recommend somebody go through official channels or not based on the motivation that journalists go by. I haven't personally encountered a situation like that, so I don't know how I would necessarily go about dealing with it. I'm sorry, that's not a great answer.
We have 3 minutes left, so for a few more questions, we can...
You had mentioned previously about how to communicate between a source and a journalist and using some additional software. What about things like iPhone messages app? I hear a lot about difficulty with that, law enforcement not appreciating the encryption there. Do you know much about that?
I can't speak too much about the journalism source relationship on that. I mean, If it's something super sensitive, I probably wouldn't recommend just using it even with Apple's encryption. But I think that law enforcement has various reasons why they don't like encryption. They'll immediately roll out terrorism and child pornography, and that'll be the two things they always point at. But really, you know, is that all they're ever going to go after? If that's, you know, if they're able to have, you know, backdoors into encryption, I don't know.
I'm curious about why recommending the other applications over.
Oh, so I want to be careful not to recommend any specific applications like endorsing products or anything like that. These are just ones that that there are options. We have a website, Surveillance Self-Defense. It's ssd.eff.org that does have these options laid out and is sort of broken down into, you know, what your threat model is if you're if you're just an average person wanting to avoid marketing, or if you're a national security reporter, if you're an activist in a repressive regime. There's a whole series of tips and solutions and different products that you can try to match your solution.
Hopefully this will be stuff that they start teaching in journalism schools, I think, too, you know, because that's just a new area of law. I mean, and that, as far as I know, they don't teach encryption in journalism school.
They're starting to, at least the conferences. All the major journalism conferences now have sessions on that.
There's also tiers of things. Like open source, end-to-end encrypted technology where you hold the key is different from a closed source proprietary project where the company holds the key. And that doesn't mean that one is, without fail, 100% of the time better than the other one. It just means that there are different threat models there, and there are different threats that come with using each of them. And it's a matter of being aware. And when you operate with a company, again, it all comes back to operate with the company you trust.
Oh.
We'll talk
Hi.
If they've been sued by the government, then it's a good indication that they're...
We have a few, just real quickly, we have a few guides on our site that encryption scorecard that you can look at and see how they did based on the criteria that our technologists put up. So. Well, I don't know how much AT&T was caving to pressure versus volunteering,
Sorry. Is there any truth to supposedly journalists are actually on a list of suspected potential terrorists in the United States?
Boy, I think that there was one Snowden story that came out regarding a terrorist screening database, but I don't believe that there were any journalists on there. There were some prominent Muslim Americans on there who are in academia.
There's an Al Jazeera reporter on there.
Was there an Al Jazeera? But I mean, the first program, which hasn't got a lot of reporting, which Thomas Drake has testified about, I mean, is basically journalists being targeted specifically for surveillance.
Well, that so raises a really interesting question, and that is there a legal definition for who is a journalist?
Oh, jeez.
I don't think so.
No. I mean,
not in the U.S.
I think some states do, though. I think some state level might have definitions in place in terms of who gets a press badge from your city council.
We're almost out of time.
I mean, I could speak loudly enough to
hear about it. It records the video, yeah.
You know, it's actually a good thing that this gentleman here brought that up, because I remember there's some thing that was parodied earlier about Hillary Clinton claiming you needed a license to be a journalist in this country. I don't know. It was a political cartoon at first, so I don't even know where it came from.
Badges and stuff like that for press conferences.
There are registered journalists. Like the White House Corps they have badges. That doesn't mean that to be a journalist, you have to have a badge.
But whenever the debate comes up over a potential federal whistleblower law, that's where you start getting really heated about who's a journalist, who's not a journalist. And Dianne Feinstein has certainly tried to draw a line between who can and can't be a journalist. But federal shield law doesn't tend to get very far in Congress. Unfortunately.
I don't like Dianne Feinstein. Yeah. Well, I think we're about out of time. Thank you very much. Thank you.